Uh-oh, healthcare co-ops, they may be coming your way. Are you ready?
Co-op fans, rejoice. If you want to make it through this nightmare alive, you and your co-op partner will need to work together. If you get in trouble, you know your partner has your back. They can resuscitate you so you can fight on. If you still need a health boost after your brush with death, your partner can help you there too. Altogether, you have an experience tailor-made for cooperation. You gotta learn to take your medicine.
Co-ops will save us? It works in the video game Resident Evil, but what about the new healthcare economy? Obama is watching our backs? What's the name of that game? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to find out about co-ops on the program this morning, Tuesday, September 15th. I'm John Hockenberry, and also an explosive, epic battle.
I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
Between China and the U.S., the weapons, chickens, and tires. We'll talk about it in just a moment. Plus, Takeaway sports god Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen breaks down the big upset in tennis last night, and a health conversation about the five-fingered monster that can kill you. Yes, hands and H1N1 flu. First, Peter Farrow is CEO of Group Health Cooperative of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Peter, we talked a little bit in jest there at the beginning of the hour about co-ops watching your back, but it's a serious question. Are nonprofit health insurance cooperatives capable of watching our backs in this healthcare debate?
You know, I think they are. There's certainly a lot of details to work out, but if they're set up properly, the cooperative structure, I think, is promising for what we're talking about, because it's governed by members, and so the organization is aligned with their interests.
Well, it is all about the setup, and that's what Congress is going to be trying to hash out. We're going to talk about that in just a moment with Peter Farrow about those details right now. Everything else you need to know this morning in the headlines, healthcare, and President Obama is talking about it as well. Later today, he's going to visit auto workers in Ohio, talk to union members at the AFL-CIO convention in Pittsburgh. The economy is also a key focus for his talk. The president's trip begins after some key economic indicators come out from the government. We're going to get the latest figures on wholesale prices and retail sales. In Hollywood, Patrick Swayze is dead at 57 of pancreatic cancer. He played lovers and fighters on the big screen. His major movies including Dirty Dancing, Ghost, Roadhouse, and Point Break. We're going to look at his career and impact a little later on in the hour. Looking overseas, a top Al-Qaeda leader is dead after a U.S. raid in Somalia. Salah Ali Salah Naban is tied to several Al-Qaeda-linked plots. He may have helped the 1998 attack on two American embassies in Africa. Our partner, the BBC, reports that America's top commander in Iraq is urging Washington not to forget about the mission in Iraq. In a new interview, General Ray Odierno says he doesn't want the new focus on Afghanistan to detract from the continuing Iraq effort. Wall Street gained less than 1% yesterday. The Dow opens today at 96.27. The S&P starts trading at 10.49. The NASDAQ begins at 20.92. After being pretty negative for most of the morning, the futures suggest a flat opening when Wall Street gets into business in about an hour and a half from now. Outbursts. Everyone's having them. Are they a bad thing?
This is Mike from Wayne, New Jersey. In my opinion, outbursts are a perfectly natural reaction to stressful situations. It's not a matter of whether you have an outburst, but what kind of outburst do you have? Serena Williams threatening the judge is probably not the best thing. She could have just shouted or screamed.
Serena Williams, Kanye West, Joe Wilson, outbursts. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Do you think your Wu-Tang sword can defeat me?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Latest report out of Washington is not about health care. It's about the House apparently getting set to vote at some point to sanction Representative Joe Wilson for his outburst last week while Barack Obama was speaking about health care. We're talking about outbursts this hour on The Takeaway, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Everyone's having them. Kanye West, Serena Williams. You know, what do you think about all of this? But on the issue of health care, it's much more sober sounding language.
We've not yet reached conclusion. There are literally 100 issues that come up as you're trying to do this in, you know, exchanges and co-ops and all of these things. That's the work that is still ongoing.
Serious work. No outbursts there. We're talking about co-ops. What do they mean? What will they actually do for you? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent, is here to talk about the obstacles to the health care bill, which in some ways in the Senate and House is keeping the whole issue of co-ops from coming into focus for consumers. But before we talk about co-ops, Todd, where do we stand on the Senate's bill, which is looking more and more like the template for an actual reform law that will be voted on the floor in both the House and the Senate?
Oh, hi, good morning, John. I was just trying to keep my outburst in. Sorry, I have to tamp that down a little bit before we get started.
If you do an outburst on this show, you're not going to get on Leno to say you're sorry to me, okay?
That's actually, sure. The thing is, I might. And so I'm I think the best thing to do is to plan one. But anyway.
In your dreams, pal! Sorry. Excuse me. Go ahead. Anyway, the bill, the obstacles.
September 15th was Max Baucus's latest deadline to get the finance bill done, with hopefully an agreement between the Gang of Six, the three Republicans and the three Democrats. Well, that's today. It's looking like the unveiling of the bill or the finishing of the bill won't happen today. In fact, it almost definitely won't, and they're looking at tomorrow. So there are a couple of issues that they're still talking about. The main structure of this bill is done, but what they're dealing with now are some of the issues that we've been hearing about over the last week, especially since Joe Wilson had his outburst.
Right.
Immigration is something they're dealing with.
So the Democrats, people who are illegally in the United States won't have a crack at any sort of subsidized reform or insurance program. Is that basically the idea?
Not only that, the subsidies is one part, you're right, but the national exchange, which is merely a marketplace of private plans, and there's not going to be a public option most likely at this point. So you're talking about a collection of private plans. It's looking like illegal immigrants will not even have access to the exchange, won't even be able to shop, in other words. Right now, an illegal immigrant can buy private insurance. You can't stop them.
Or they can pay retail at the emergency room, you know, if they want.
Correct. And that's the dynamic that's bothering a lot of people about this, because if you shut out illegal immigrants, you know, for political reasons or even for good reasons, that's fine. But they're still going to show up at the emergency room at the expense of you and me.
Right,
so that's pretty controversial. The other, of course, is abortion, making sure that not only people who get subsidies, federal money, can't use the money to get abortions, which is already in federal law in Medicare and Medicaid and other public programs. It's already in there. But again, people who access the exchange, which are private plans, also won't be able to somehow use those benefits for abortion. That's a little complicated because, again, these are private benefits. And you can
it's an indication politically that the Democrats aren't going to challenge this longstanding Republican anti-abortion provision on federal money for abortions, right?
That's right. And it's a little bit frustrating to some Democrats because there's no indication that a single Republican is necessarily even going to sign on.
Mm-hmm.
So they're walking around the Senate going, sort of the politics, but why are we doing this?
That's
they haven't
point.
Said they're going to support the bill.
All right. Well,
so
we want to talk about the details of co-ops and how practical they are with some people who have some experience with them. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. We're going to talk with you actually later on in the program about some other questions waiting from listeners on the healthcare debate. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So rejoining us now, Peter Farrow, CEO of Group Health Cooperative of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. He's in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Thanks for being with us, Peter.
Thank you, John.
And Timothy Jost joins us. He's a law professor at Washington and Lee University and a health policy expert in Lexington, Virginia. Timothy Jost, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Yes, thank you.
So, Peter Farrow, let's go back to the question I asked you at the top of the hour. If healthcare nonprofit cooperatives are the solution that Washington is going to look to in healthcare reform, why does that make you feel good?
Two things. One, I think it's certainly better than a public option, and for a couple of reasons. One, it gets around a lot of the bureaucracy of having the government set up a program. But I think that the cooperatives provide a good structure. Certainly, there are several of them in practice around the country in a couple of different models. But the primary reason, because members are helping to govern the plan or actively involved in the governance of the plan, the interests of the plan are aligned with the membership.
Although, why did co-ops go away? They used to be prevalent in the United States, and then they all went private and modeled the sort of corporate private insurer model. Why?
Well, they didn't all go away. Some of us are still out there. There are some challenges with co-ops that we have to realistically consider. One of them is the funding of them. Startup costs and seed money are certainly harder to get with a cooperative, just because you don't have the financing options like issuing public stock or something like that.
Right. I mean, you can't go to investors and say you want to invest in something that's going to be nonprofit. They go, no. In fact, I avoid those kinds of investments.
Exactly.
Yeah. Timothy Jost, Peter Farrow describes some of the challenges to starting up co-ops. Where do you see the challenges, in your view, as a law professor at Washington and Lee University?
Well, I think the goal of healthcare reform, as it's been articulated all along, is to give us affordable coverage, to give us health security, to give us choice. And for that to happen, we need competition. And in most markets in the United States right now, you do not have competition. In 16 states, you have one carrier with 50% or more. In 36 states, the top three carriers have 65% or more of the market. In Eau Claire, Wisconsin, if you look at the combined PPO and HMO market, according to AMA figures, the Big Blue has 84% of the market. And so what
Big
you
Blue
to,
meaning the mean, group health cooperative?
No, meaning yeah. Anthem or WellPoint or okay. whatever it is right
the
now.
The private insurers, okay.
Yeah, the private Blue Cross insurers. Blue Cross Blue Shield started out as nonprofits. And what happened is that they became, well, many of them became for-profits, but even the nonprofits just became indistinguishable from commercial insurers. There are a handful of cooperatives in the country. All the ones that I've heard of are a quarter century or more old. Maybe there are some new ones. I haven't heard about them.
And they're also in states with a less diverse population than, say, New York and California.
Yeah, they're in rural states. They're in states with a history of agricultural cooperatives or electrical cooperatives. And I think it's a model that works fine for its members, but I think in terms of being able to compete with the big insurers, to take market share away from the big insurers, to offer lower prices, it's not going to happen nationally.
All right, let's get a comment from Peter Farrow. Why haven't you in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, managed to leverage some market share away from Big Blue, as Timothy Jost points out?
Well, I think Timothy's one is numbers aren't quite accurate. Certainly in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, the market share data that he was quoting is way off. We have a sizable share of the market in western Wisconsin, somewhere around maybe 20% of the commercial market. For managed care. And in Wisconsin in general, there isn't a health plan that has more than 15% of the overall insured market. So, and Blue Cross certainly doesn't have a dominant share in any way, shape, or form.
Well, let's talk about the setup, because the bill that's coming out of Washington is going to be creating new co-ops to come in and presumably take the uninsured and what I assume would be young people who are joining the market for the very first time. Is that a reasonable market to set up a business, even a nonprofit business, Timothy Jost?
I think the big problem of setting up something that can compete with the big insurance companies is not so much the membership, although that's a big problem too, because you have to establish brand identity. But the big problem in most markets is getting a provider network, and getting a provider network that will give you prices competitive to what they give the dominant insurers. Now, the cooperatives that have been around for a quarter century already have their provider network. But in most instances, you're going to have to be moving into a market
right.
that is already sewed up by the big insurers, and trying to convince the providers that they should give you a better rate or as good a rate so that you can compete with the big insurers. And you're right, if you're offering them people who they don't know who they are and they don't know what kind of premiums they're going to generate.
Right. All right, Timothy Jost, law professor at Washington Lee University and a health policy expert. Peter Farrow, CEO of Group Health Cooperative in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Final thought, if you could. Can the federal government accomplish this sort of leveraging into the market?
You know what? I think they can. And the issue isn't we need a bigger bully. The issue is we need better service. And that's what cooperatives are going to provide.
All right. Peter Farrow and Timothy Jost, thanks so much for that discussion. Peter Farrow is the CEO of Group Health Cooperative in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Timothy Jost, a professor at Washington and Lee University.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hear that lyric? Here are two people who died in the past week, actor Patrick Swayze and Jim Carroll. That's Carroll singing his song, People Who Die. As far as we know, Swayze and Carol were not friends. But in a kind of fable of celebrity, these two very different people bookend the dream of making it big. Here's Swayze with his mainstream pop heroics.
She's like the wind through my tree.
That's Swayze himself singing in his breakout film, Dirty Dancing. And then there's Jim Carroll, the dark, troubled, gifted bad boy who is capable of anything.
Ma? Are you there?
Yeah.
I need you to give me like $5, like $20, something like that, because I'm in some trouble. Ma? Do you hear me, Ma?
That's actor Leonardo DiCaprio playing Jim Carroll in The Basketball Diaries, his memoir of being a gifted shooter in high school who had a chance to go pro and threw it all away in a haze of drugs and self-abuse. Here's Carroll himself reading from his work.
The bell rings. It's a decade past my decadence. My beast wears rings. He's waiting in the shadows of my hesitations, my silent hesitations. The image is so clear. It seems I have no hands.
Jim Carroll's work was inspiring, but also toxic. It's believed that Basketball Diaries partly inspired the shooters at Columbine High School's massacre in 1999. Patrick Swayze was inspiring in an utterly different way. Here he is speaking to Whoopi Goldberg from Beyond the Grave to save his girlfriend in the blockbuster movie Ghost.
You are going to help me. There's a woman. Her name is Molly Jensen, and she's in terrible danger. The man who killed me broke into our apartment, and he's going to go back. So you've got to warn her.
Just what makes you think she's going to listen to me?
It's just a phone call.
Here's Patrick Swayze inspiring other performers in this interview back in 1995.
If you live through the initial stages of fame and get past it and remember that's not who you are is this hype, then you have a hope of maybe learning how to spell the word artist.
The song is Jim Carroll's Catholic Boy. There's nothing particular to make of these two lives, so utterly parallel, yet intersecting almost at the end. Even in their deaths, the differences in Swayze and Carroll say so much about the Hollywood fame circus of today. Jim Carroll's death was barely noticed. He died at 60 of a heart attack on that darkest of days, September 11th, last week. His health struggles, private, out of view, his gifts almost thrown away. The waste, a part of fame's deal with the devil. Patrick Swayze died yesterday after a very public 2-year struggle with pancreatic cancer, in which his work in a television series, The Beast, was an emblem of the fight to live no matter what and to go out on top, as he did famously in Dirty Dancing's unforgettable finale.
Sorry about the disruption, folks, but I always do the last dance of the season. This year somebody told me not to. So I'm going to do my kind of dancing with the great part.
Patrick Swayze and Jim Carroll. These are people who died. They were both our friends in different ways. Jim Carroll, we certainly say, but they died. Hey,
it's difficult to explain this moment, you know. Since young, I bring with this, and we take this trophy with me, you know, and now I'm done, you know. I did my dream.
It's not the fire of an Argentinian there, but it's certainly the sense of victory from Juan Martín del Potro, who beat Roger Federer in an amazing upset last night at the U.S. Open. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here in the studio. You picked Federer yesterday, dude.
I think everyone in the world picked Federer, especially because he had won 5 in a row previous, and he had won some like 21 straight Grand Slam matches. He was on a roll, a serious roll, and I guess he ran into the 6'6", 20-year-old Juan Martín del Potro, and it was his first time in a Grand Slam final and his first time winning.
And he had dispatched previously in the semis Rafael Nadal in straight sets. This is, I believe, the first time a number 6 dispatched a 2 and a 1 in the world to make it to a Grand Slam championship.
He shrugged off. He kind of got rid of those nerves, and he came into this match really nervous. And the first set, he dropped to Federer, and it looked like he wasn't going to have a great match. But sometimes when you're the most nervous, that means you're the most ready.
That was certainly evidenced in the end, where he really crushed Federer in that last tiebreaker. It was sad to watch Federer go down, but it was so exciting to see this new player emerge, Del Potro. So the Monday Night Football game last night was a test of Brady and Terrell Owen. The Buffalo Bills and the New England Patriots played last night. What do we know?
Well, it was an amazing game. I think we had two games last night, and the NFL took advantage of two markets. We had the San Diego Chargers and Oakland Raiders on the West Coast, and the Patriots and the Bills on the East Coast. Both games came down to the last couple minutes of the game. Both games were thrilling, and both games showcased two divisional rivalries from the old AFL playing in their old throwback uniforms. So it was a great night of football, and if you watched it, you saw some late-night heroics from Tom Brady.
Brady brought it in the fourth quarter, but the fact that the Bills were so close, does that bode ill for the New England Patriots?
I think what it says is that the Patriots aren't as good as we think they are, and it says the Bills aren't as bad as we think that they are. And probably the same thing for the Chargers. The Chargers are better, not as good, and same thing with the Raiders. The Raiders played some great football last night.
Injury report, Ibrahim. Brian Urlacher of the Bears out for the year. That's a huge defensive loss. And Paolo Mala of the Steelers, what about that?
Well, Palomalo probably will be back in 6 weeks, so his injury is not as serious for the Steelers, and they have a very good organization. They can patch that up. The Bears, on the other hand, have a lot of other issues on the quarterback side, and defensively, now you lose the quarterback of the defense, that really messes up the situation. They're going to be looking for linebackers around the league.
So we talked about outbursts yesterday, particularly Serena Williams at the U.S. Open, and we were both talking about the potential racial implications of her getting called for that and losing the match at the U.S. Open. You raised the racial issue, and our listeners came back with like a zillion emails. Here's one. Even if the judge was incorrect, that doesn't give Ms. Williams the right to get a free pass for her tirade. The lessons I teach my children is to work through such situations. There are no factors that excuse such behavior. You weren't excusing Serena yesterday, were you?
Not in a million years. I think she was 100% in the wrong. And I think what was appropriate is that they fined her $10,500 for that outburst. I do think it was inappropriate for a judge to call a foul on a match point play.
And face it, we felt her pain losing the U.S. Open, regardless of how out of control she was.
And I think it also takes away from Kim Clijsters amazing victory and her whole comeback story, which really was the story of the tournament.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor, thanks so much.
Good morning.
We want your take. Are outbursts really a bad thing, even in tennis? And just saying, I'm sorry, make it okay. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm John Huckenberry. Good morning. Coming up, an epic battle between the U.S. and China.
I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
The weapons are what your car runs on, tires, and what chickens run on, their feet. The details in just a moment. But first, Femi Oke has a check on some of today's top stories.
Hello there. 28 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama has a busy day traveling. He's expected to visit auto workers at a GM plant in Ohio to discuss the economy. He will also attend the AFL-CIO convention in Pittsburgh to talk with union members about healthcare reform. The Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus says that he'll have a formal healthcare reform proposal very soon. The Associated Press reports that he'll announce his plans tomorrow. Today, Todd Zwillick, our DC correspondent, says that senators on the Finance Committee will meet with governors to talk about the cost implications of healthcare reform. Overseas, American and Somali officials say that U.S. forces have been involved in an attack on al-Qaeda-linked militants in East Africa. Our partner, the New York Times, says that one of those killed was, I'm going to quote here, one of the most wanted Islamic militants in Africa. And finally, an upset at the U.S. Open. Juan Martín del Potro of Argentina defeated Roger Federer in the men's singles final. Federer is a 5-time U.S. Open champion, and del Potro is just 20 years old. That's a look at big stories that I'm following this morning.
Thank you, Femi. Later on this hour, the lost symbol has been found by some crazed book buyers. Dan Brown's got a new one. We'll talk about it in just about 10 minutes. But tires. Tire makers have a problem. I mean, all tires look alike, so what are advertisers and companies to do to create a brand for themselves? Here's Bridgestone Tire's solution in a famous Super Bowl ad.
And squeeze those buns. You are so worth it. Come on, girls. Squeeze, squeeze, tone, tone. Ah!
The drive.
drivers who want to get the most out of their cars.
That is fantastic. I believe
it's Bridgestone or nothing.
Bridgestone, of course, a Japanese tire company, and one that's in the middle of the crosshairs as over the weekend, the Barack Obama slaps a 35% tariff on Chinese-made tires, which means that consumers are going to have to learn a little more about the rubber that hits the road there on their automobiles and vehicles. Mike Cockrell joins us. He's chief financial officer of Sanderson Farms, who's in this battle of a trade war that's looming between China and the United States, joining us from Laurel, Mississippi. And Ross Cogle is president of Tire Wholesalers, based in Troy, Michigan, who's written on the subject of this tariff. First of all, Ross Cogle, good morning.
Good morning.
How difficult is it for consumers to know where their tires come from, either the United States, China, Japan, or anywhere else?
No, it's not that hard. They can just look on the side of the tire. Most of them say made in the USA or made in China. So, but the majority of the tires that are affected by the tariff that are coming in are entry-level tires. They're Tier 3 tires. The Bridgestone ad that you just played, you know, that really focuses on mid to higher end tires, and most of the tires that are affected by the tax, in my mind, are entry level tires.
Now, when you say entry level tires, you mean super cheap tires coming from China, and not tires like, say, Cooper tires. They have factories in China, but Cooper tires made in China would not be affected by this tariff, correct?
Some are, some aren't, but the vast majority of tires, if you're looking for big picture comments, the vast majority of tires that are made in China that are coming to the United States right now are Tier 3 or entry-level tires. They're for the person that goes into a store and doesn't say, I want the Bridgestone, I want the Goodyear. They want to say, I want the least expensive tire possible. And, of course, those are the tires that are most difficult for manufacturers to make profitably.
And in many ways, that is, you know, the greater likelihood of consumers these days who are affected by the recession, who may be out of work, who, if they get a flat tire, they're not interested in the brand. They just want to get their car back on the road, and they want the low-end tire, right?
Yeah, and in Michigan, we definitely see that.
And this is who this tariff is going to hurt, in addition to the Chinese. Now, the Chinese, of course, struck back, threatening to restrict chicken parts sales, a main export from the United States to China. Mike Cockrell, that's definitely in your portfolio. What's the impact of China retaliating on chicken parts in the Sanderson Farms business?
Well, good morning, John, and thanks for having me.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, time will tell. The Chinese government announced yesterday that they were going to begin an investigation, an anti-dumping investigation against the United States chicken industry. And, of course, they did not overtly say that they were doing that in retaliation for the administration's tariff on tires. But the timing is certainly interesting. And it's not the first time chicken has been pulled into these type of battles. The previous administration put a tariff on steel imported from Russia back in 2002, and Russia promptly began having, quote, health concerns about United States chicken and embargoed United States chicken for a period of time.
This has just got to be awful on so many levels for you. I mean, the last thing any chicken producer wants is to have a conversation with the word rubber in it, right? I mean, that's number one. Number two, do the Chinese have a case on dumping that they can actually make at the World Trade Organization?
Oh, they really don't. The charge is specious at best, because the most of the product that is sold to China, the primary product is chicken paws or feet, and those products are sold there at a premium because they are much desired in China, and we don't even have another market for those products. Really, if those products were not sold to China, they would probably be treated as offal or byproduct and sold to the rendering plant. So it's not that I don't believe there's any merit to the claim at all, but it does raise another issue at a time when our industry is struggling significantly and has for the last year. Most players in our industry have gone through a very difficult time, just like many in our economy, and it's not what the industry needs.
Then to both of you, Russ Cogle, president of Tire Wholesalers in Troy, Michigan, and Mike Cockrell, chief financial officer of Sanderson Farms, the intent by the Obama administration and China is to injure the corporations and the trade policies of these companies. But who are the consumers that are likely to be hurt here in the United States and in China? Ross, you first. On the tire question, which consumers are going to be hurt?
Oh, definitely the consumers that are looking for the least expensive product. The people that walk into a store and say, you know, I want the least expensive tire and I have the least amount of money to spend, which assumedly are going to be people in lower to middle class America.
Now, the president was speaking at the AFL-CIO convention today. He'll presumably say that this will save jobs in the tire industry. Do you believe that, Ross?
Yes, except that it will save approximately 4,000 jobs, and even that is a dubious claim. And a recent study by Thomas Prusa from Rutgers University argues that it will cost 25,000 jobs in the tire industry.
Mike Cockrola, take us out with a final thought here. Chief Financial Officer of Sanderson Farms, who's likely to be injured besides the trade policies of the Obama administration and individual corporations?
Well, obviously, as you just said, the industry in the United States will be injured, but the consumers that will be injured in this particular instance are the Chinese consumers. There's not another source for them to get the pause that they want and that they enjoy, and other than from the United States industry.
Well, it's an interesting insight. Not an industry we typically focus on, tires or chicken paws, chicken feet, literally, but it's definitely center stage in this trade battle between the U.S. and China. Mike Cockrell of Sanderson Farms, we thank you, and Ross Kogel of Tire Wholesalers. Not Harry Potter, but people stayed up until midnight to get Dan Brown's new book, The Lost Symbol. We'll find it in just a moment. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And we're happy to be joined by Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, who's in Washington, D.C. this morning, where she's got a terrific story, real blockbuster. Let's lay out some of the details. First of all, good morning, Louise.
Morning.
And just as Washington is beginning the debate about regulatory regimes to restore trust to Wall Street, a federal judge takes a look at the Securities and Exchange Commission fine, $33 million, of the Bank of America on the issue of granting bonuses to Merrill Lynch when Bank of America took over Merrill Lynch at the height of the financial meltdown. A federal judge says $33 million, that fine, which represents something like 1% of the amount of bonuses paid to Merrill Lynch executives, you must be out of your minds. This was a real lambasting by a federal judge. Describe some of the details.
Yeah, it was a scathing ruling. He said that this settlement between the SEC and Bank of America was a contrivance. He said that basically it was a way for the SEC to claim that it was exposing wrongdoing while the bank could claim that this was overzealous regulators. But he said, in fact, that was really hiding the truth of the matter.
So let's just back up there for a second. I mean, a federal judge is saying that the Securities and Exchange Commission, the chief regulator in the financial industry, is colluding, in a sense, with Bank of America in the middle of a merger using taxpayer money.
That is the implication
you
can draw from this ruling. I mean, it didn't totally surprise me because I've been following this closely more than a month. And I'll tell you, in the hearing just over a month ago, when SEC presented the settlement with the Bank of America to the judge, it was striking because the judge would ask the SEC basic factual questions about the merger, and the SEC wouldn't know the answers, and Bank of America's lawyers kept going up and whispering the answers to the SEC
in
front of us.
Oh, that's amazing.
And you're watching this and you're saying, wow, this is justice at work. And the judge has
Or you're saying, do I see what I'm seeing here? I mean,
yeah, that's what you're saying. I mean, it was very striking. And since then, the judge has asked both parties to file a series of documents with him to give him answers on who made the decisions not to tell shareholders about Merrill's bonuses.
Right. Well, Louise,
and you know what happened is they didn't answer the question.
They didn't answer the question. Well, the import of the ruling is this goes to trial, right?
So the parties can appeal to have it, you know, taken over by a higher court or to have summary judgment.
But if this goes to trial, this is a precedent-setting case potentially in terms of shareholder rights and in terms of the role of the SEC, right?
That's right, and particularly for the time that we're in now, because a lot of people feel that the SEC slipped up in its job of investor protection as well as its job of watching the investment banks leading into the financial crisis. And, you know, in Washington right now, everyone's talking about what powers different regulators should have. So certainly the SEC's reputation is on the line.
And it's on the line with the image of Bank of America whispering things into those SEC lawyers' ears during that original hearing. Louise Story, New York Times finance reporter, talking to us from Washington, where the issue of regulation in the new era of the financial sector is definitely on the table. Thanks so much, Louise.
Listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Da Vinci Code Dan Brown's got a new book. Publishers have a new blockbuster. Is there more to it? We'll find out in just a minute. We're also talking about outbursts. Everyone's doing them, it seems. Kanye West, Serena Williams, Joe Wilson. Are outbursts really a bad thing?
Chris, White Lake, Michigan. I think what Joe Wilson done, in my eyes, the man's a hero. If you ever watched me on television, he got everybody looking at each other, snickering, talking in each other's ear. He just had the nerve to say it. I praise him for that.
Nerve, like Kanye Wilson had on Jay Leno to make it okay, or his outburst at the MTV Music Video Awards. We want your take on all this at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now let's get a check on the morning's top stories with Femi Okay.
Thank you, John. Almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Just looking at the Associated Press Newswire, they are saying that Vice President Joe Biden is in Iraq to meet with U.S. troops and Iraqi leaders. Two top-shelf economic indicators are just out this hour. Retail sales are up more than expected, and wholesale prices also soared well above predictions. A deal on a health care bill could be close in the Senate. Democratic Senate Finance Chair Max Baucus says that he will unveil a compromise bill tomorrow. He hopes the lower price tag will get a few Republican votes. Overseas, a top al-Qaeda leader is dead after a U.S. raid in Somalia. Saleh Ali Saleh Nabhan is tied to several terror plots. Those are some of the big stories we're following this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi. Well, Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code, has a new mystery. Listen to this.
I'm into something here that I cannot understand.
We are in the middle of a war, one that's been going on forever. Protect a secret so powerful that if revealed, it would devastate the very foundations of mankind.
What are you talking about?
You asked what would be worth killing for. Witness the biggest cover-up in human history.
Well, maybe it's not a cover-up, but it is a mystery. That's from The Da Vinci Code, the movie. Tom Holbrook joins us. He's the owner of River Run Bookstore in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
Why is Dan Brown's new book the top seller on Amazon.com weeks before it was even available for sale?
Well, one is advertising, one is media, but I think what a lot of people forget is that The Da Vinci Code was really fascinating and attention-grabbing. It's several years now, and we look back, and when you think about it, you tend to think about, oh, the biggest selling book ever, what a bestseller, it sold a million books. But at the time, what grabbed people was that it was a sort of hand grenade of a book. It seemed like a thriller, but it just unpacked all of these crazy ideas that, while they'd been around for a long time, the average person maybe didn't know about. And
Da Vinci Code was the perfect conspiracy theorist's book because it basically said all these weird little symbols around you have a secret meaning, and here's the story behind it, right?
Yes, except that it wasn't, I mean, if only conspiracy theorists were into it, it wouldn't have sold millions of copies. It sort of awakened the conspiracy theorists in all of us, I think. But also, people, again, latch onto that. For me, personally, I was very fascinated with the art and the science that was in that book. So I think people have forgotten the many, many ways it intrigued, and I think the Lost Symbol's probably going to do the same thing for people.
Well, the marketers seem to have forgotten that Da Vinci Code was a word-of-mouth bestseller that grew out of readers telling other readers, you have to read this, you have to read this, you have to read this. Does Lost Symbol work as a standard blockbuster where everybody's got to get it, like, right off the bat?
I think everyone's going to want to get it right off the bat or within the first couple of days, so because nobody wants the surprise, you know, spoiled. And for a lot of people with the Da Vinci Code, it was word of mouth, but also it was a very sophisticated marketing campaign that built that word of mouth. It was, I think it was groundbreaking in that Random House made sure a copy of that book was in as many booksellers' hands 6 months before it came out as possible.
Well, for the lost symbol, I mean, not as though Portsmouth, New Hampshire is, you know, the Times Square of the reading public world, but what was it like at midnight outside your store?
It was pretty quiet, actually. I mean, I don't think it had the, it didn't have the fervor, have to know what happens of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, but again, I think people, the media obviously is all whipped up about it, but I think the average reading public has sort of forgotten what made the Da Vinci Code really interesting, and it's the same thing. They're gonna start hearing about the book, and they're gonna start hearing about what it's about, and I think it'll be huge.
Well, we'll see if the lost symbol will remind them. The books are certainly stacked up there at River Run Bookstore that Tom Holbrook owns in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Don't you see them? Damn it! It must be here. I have to find it. It must be somewhere. You must help me find it.
Help me find it. That's a scene from The Beast with Five Fingers about a hand that turned into a monster. Joining us now is Tara Parker Pope, who writes the Well column for our partner, The New York Times. In the H1N1 era right now, as we head into flu season, quite literally, everybody's hand is the beast with five fingers capable of transmitting swine flu, right, Tara?
Well, at any time, our hands are, you know, definitely covered with germs. And I think it's interesting because people hear this advice about washing your hands. We've heard it from our mothers. Now we're hearing it from health officials. I heard it the other day at my daughter's school. The nurse was giving a lecture to the parents, hand washing. And people aren't really paying attention. It doesn't sound very important, but the data show that it's really quite important in staying healthy.
Well, how does this new report in the journal Risk Analysis really add to the sort of cliche of wash your hands? Everybody's told that, but, you know, as you say, people don't pay attention.
Well, there's a couple studies that came out of Berkeley that are quite fascinating, looking at how often we touch our faces. And the scientists at Berkeley did some mathematical models to try to determine the role that clean hands or dirty hands can play in our health in flu season. And they concluded that about a third of your risk, if you were in a school or a dorm or taking care of a sick family member, about a third of your chance of getting sick comes from hand-to-face contact. So touching your lips, your nose, your eyes, that's a big way that we get the flu. And I think once you realize how important your hands are in this, then you start looking at them differently and you know, thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I need to wash more often.
It's the beast with five fingers, in fact. So let's talk a little bit about countermeasures. Does hand sanitizer help, or is it more we have to wash our hands and keep them in our pockets?
This is the thing. I mean, hand sanitizer, alcohol, you want to use an alcohol-based sanitizer, but it's really just as effective. In fact, they recently did a study in Australia where they took a seasonal version of H1N1. It wasn't the swine flu, but it was an H1N1 virus. And they, you know, used copious amounts on these volunteers who had all had a flu shot, thankfully, to lower their chance of actually getting sick from this experiment. But it's the equivalent. What they put on your hands is if you have a runny nose and you have the flu and you wipe your nose with your hand, that is a lot of virus you're putting on your hands. They, you know, replicated this. And then they compared soap and water, alcohol-based sanitizers. It's about the same. And they're both very effective. So it's always good to wash your hands. Personally, you know, I like to actually wash away, you know, the grime from my hands with soap and water. But if you're someplace in school or before you eat or in a restaurant, you know, these hand sanitizers are quite effective.
Well,
let's talk
Let's talk about one piece of data in this, study, this set of studies that really caught my eye. On average, students touch their eyes, noses, and lips 47 times during a 3-hour period. That's once every 4 minutes. Between washings, how long do you have before your hands once again become a virus vector and become as filthy and, transmittable as they were before you washed?
Well, it all depends on where you are and what you're doing. And that's why this paying attention to how often you touch your face is so important. You know, they did a study it just appeared, I think, this month in a medical journal. In Britain, they talked to commuters about hand washing and they tested their hands. And people were just as likely to say they'd wash their hands as not. But they found out that a quarter of these people had fecal bacteria on their hands. Now, half these people who had contaminated hands said they had just washed their hands. So it suggests either they're lying or they may have just picked it up on the train or the bus or wherever. There, you know, so that's why this hand-to-face contact is so important.
Right.
You don't realize how often you are touching your face, and you don't know what's on your hands. So that's why I think frequent hand washing and don't touch your face all the time. Don't, if you do your own experiment, sit there for a while and you know, you'll just start realizing how often you want to reach and rub your nose or scratch your eye.
Oh, that's a good experiment. Tara Parker Pope writes the Well column for our partner, the New York Times. Hand washing, it's pretty important. Handshaking, maybe we should do without it during the flu season, where your hands are all the beasts with five fingers. Tara, thanks so much. We're also talking about outbursts, not viral outbursts. Everyone's doing them. Verbal outbursts. Kanye West, Serena Williams, Joe Wilson. Are they a bad thing? And can you say I'm sorry like tearful Kanye West did last night on Jay Leno and make it okay? We're listening to your responses at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you can tell us anything that's got you talking, of course. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. You can take our podcast to go and subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm controlling an outburst right now, in fact. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. I guess when you get down to basics, it's really all about trust.
We will not go back to the days of reckless behavior and unchecked excess that was at the heart of this crisis, where too many were motivated only by the appetite for quick kills and bloated bonuses.
Trust in me, baby. Give me time. Give me time. Please, a little more time.
Well, 1 year after the financial crisis erupted, Barack Obama goes to Wall Street to ask Wall Street for the one thing of real value it may have lost in all this chaos: trust. Question: does the financial system have anybody's confidence anymore? When trusting too much is not enough on Wall Street, there's your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, September 15th. You can trust me. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, we'll pick up the common thread among Republican Congressman Joe Wilson, Serena Williams, and Kanye West. Outbursts, a civil conversation about controversial public outbursts. Also, Ted Kennedy in his own words. But first, Peter Morici, economist, business professor at the University of Maryland, talking about trust on Wall Street. Is regulation, new regulation, going to restore trust in the banking sector? And who needs to trust Wall Street more, American consumers or Chinese investors?
Well, I don't think we'll ever fully restore trust, because I don't think it's going to be possible. At least the president's not wholly committed to truly regulating derivatives. They mutate. They're very highly engineered, and the Wall Street folks are absolutely so creative in creating new products that create new risks for the system. As for the Chinese investors, I don't particularly worry about them. It's really the Chinese government that buys the treasury bills. They buy them to suppress their currency, to boost their exports, to increase manufacturing employment. That's their industrial policy. That's why they do it. It's not benevolence or trust.
Well, the challenges of regulating creativity on Wall Street in the era of derivatives, Peter Morici is going to stay with us, and Wall Street's former top cop, Arthur Levitt, will join the conversation on regulation in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning. In the headlines, two heavyweight economic indicators are just out last hour. Retail sales up more than expected. Wholesale prices also soared well above predictions. A deal on a health care bill seems close in the Senate. Democratic Senate Finance Chair Max Baucus says he'll unveil a compromise bill tomorrow. Health care and the economy are part of President Obama's travel schedule today. He's visiting auto workers in Ohio, and he will talk to union members at the AFL-CIO Union Convention in Pittsburgh. Actor Patrick Swayze is dead at 57 of pancreatic cancer. He played tough guys and passionate lovers. Big hits included Dirty Dancing, Ghost Roadhouse, and Point Break. All great films. A courageous performer, Patrick Swayze, dead of cancer at age 57. Looking overseas, Vice President Biden is in Iraq. The unannounced visit to troops and allies is his third trip to Iraq this year. Wall Street gained less than 1% yesterday. The Dow opens at 96.27, and the S&P starts trading at 10.49. The NASDAQ begins at 20.92. Outbursts, are they a bad thing?
to express my true feelings about outbursts, I'm going to spontaneously convert the term into a definitive anagram. Obnoxious, unnecessary tirade, barfed upon regretfully surprised target.
I think that's acronym, Troy, not an anagram, but we want your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Well, Peter Morici, our friend and the economist at the University of Maryland and professor of economics at the University of Maryland, said it right there at the top of the show. Is it possible to regulate Wall Street in the creative era of derivatives and other very, very creative and exotic kinds of securities? Well, President Obama thinks it is possible, and he sort of set up this apparent inconsistency in some strong words at Manhattan's Federal Hall overlooking the Wall Street and the New York Stock Exchange yesterday here in New York.
These rules must be developed in a way that doesn't stifle innovation and enterprise. And I want to say very clearly here today, we want to work with the financial industry to achieve that end.
Well, it's a tough challenge, and regulatory reform is the watchword both in Washington and on Wall Street. Who's listening? Well, let's find out. Certainly this morning, Arthur Levitt is listening. He's a senior advisor with the Carlyle Group, former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He joins us from the nation's capital. Good morning, Arthur Levitt.
Good morning.
And Peter Morici, of course, still with us, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland. Let me just ask you, Arthur Levitt, is there, first of all, do you agree with Peter Morici that there is an essential, perhaps, inconsistency between the creativity in the derivatives market and this idea of traditional regulation that Barack Obama talked about yesterday in his speech on Wall Street?
Well, I think the president's heart is in the right place, but his proposals are fairly general. He mentioned derivatives only once in the speech. And the real problem here is the executive branch has abdicated so much of the regulatory responsibility to the legislative branch, and Congress is enthralled to corporate interests to such an extent that the likelihood of any kind of financial reform this year, I think, is very remote.
You know, your resume, Arthur Levitt, really straddles a huge roadmap of this entire landscape. I mean, as an advisor with the Carlyle Group, but also former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, I mean, up there at Carlyle, do you feel even remotely regulated as a private equity firm by Washington?
Private equity really has not been regulated up to now, nor do I think that private equity was nearly at the heart of the problems that involved us. I think the real issues here are regulating the banks, having the banks disclose exactly the level of liabilities that they have. The real issue is accounting issues, and the independence of the independent accounting center has been compromised by being browbeaten by the Congress. So we've got a situation where of all the constituents in the United States for our markets, the business constituents have the upper hand, and the individual investor really is in bad shape. The president spoke about the investor protection organization that he is so passionate about establishing. I don't give that better than a 50-50 chance of seeing the light of day.
All right, let's get a comment from Peter Morici. Do you think an investor protection agency, whether it's residing in the Fed or in the Treasury Department, is, first of all, likely to pass? Arthur Levitt gives it less than 50-50. What do you think? And are those kinds of regulations what's needed here?
Well, yeah, I think it's the wrong thing to do. I don't think an investor protection agency would work. The bottom line is we have to effectively regulate the kinds of risks that banks take. You know, if the banks hold a collateralized debt obligation and they buy a swap to basically do a loss stop, then we need to know that swap is backed up by real assets, essentially derivatives that are used as insurance policies for financial institutions that are going to be guaranteed by the government explicitly or implicitly, have to be backed up by the necessary assets so that the institutions won't fail
in a downdraft in the market.
Well, let's back up. Let's just back out and get some of those details and try to elucidate that for listeners if we could. Now, does that mean that the government becomes like a Moody's rating agency
where they identify
risk?
When you buy an insurance policy, the government requires that the insurance company have adequate assets to pay you.
I see.
Life insurance isn't a big deal because we have actuarial tables, but hurricane insurance, okay? Whereas the banks were buying swaps, say, from AIG to ensure that the collateralized debt obligations on their SIVs would not impose loss beyond a certain point. But AIG didn't have assets to back up the swaps. And on top of that, people were trading in swaps as basically gambling.
All right, so in a regulatory regime that covers this, AIG would be required to have cash in the bank to back each one of those credit default swaps. That's the kind of regulation that Obama is calling for, right?
No. I think there's a much greater problem than this. We have institutions, banks that are now too big to fail. The government has taken the position of salvaging just about every major financial institution in America. That has a vast, vast danger to the system. And that has not been addressed by the administration's proposals. The propping up of banks such as Citibank and the Bank of America, in my judgment, was just plain wrong. When we closed down the Chorus Bank last week, that bank should have been closed down 2 years ago. If the banking system is fragile, if investors cannot trust the banking system, there cannot be any kind of consumer confidence, which is essential to restoring balanced, reasonable, fair markets.
All right,
I agree with Arthur on that.
All right, let me just remind people, we're speaking with Arthur Levitt, senior advisor with the Carlyle Group, former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and, of course, Peter Morici, frequent Takeaway guest, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland. Guys, you know, I have to say, I mean, I kind of wish we invited somebody on the program who could, you know, maybe a Larry Summers or something who could advocate for the Obama position, because it sounds like both of you are saying that essentially the White House is in collusion with the kind of business as usual mentality on Wall Street, and we're not going to get a lot of change.
I am not saying that. I am saying that the administration is so committed to health care reform that they simply lack the power and the staying power to overcome the influence of the business community on Congress, who will be the ultimate arbiters of whether we get reform and what kind of reform it might be.
I see. Peter Morici, what about the argument that, hey, look, things are doing fine, we've hit bottom here, we dodged a bullet in the financial markets, everything is fine, we'll get some regulation, maybe not the hardest core regulatory regime, but things are fine, don't worry.
Well, we haven't changed the fundamental activities that gave rise to the crisis in the first place. They're back to writing highly engineered products. They're putting aside large sums of money for huge bonuses, as opposed to stocking up money for when those derivatives may cause problems. So it's business as usual on Wall Street. There's no reason to expect that this won't happen again. Now, we have changed the mortgage writing process, but they've found new places to make money by writing highly engineered products. Mm-hmm. So there is an issue. And Arthur's quite right. I mean, the chairman of the Democratic Senator's Campaign Fundraising Committee last cycle was Chuck Schumer. It's no secret why. I mean, he's the senator from New York, and he has, you know, access to Wall Street and so forth. Wall Street is pouring so much money into Congress that it's wholly compromised. And
well, but let's talk about
the administration has abdicated regulatory responsibility, not just this administration, the last administration as well, to the Congress, and so they're counting on folks that are essentially taking a great deal of money.
Let me just back you off there for a second.
You need to look at Summers' disclosure statement and how much money he took from Wall Street just before going into the White House.
All right, let's talk about Chris Dodd for a moment before we go, because we got about a minute left, and I think it bears mentioning that Christopher Dodd in Connecticut, Democratic senator, who is the chairman of the committee that's going to oversee this legislation, is really fighting an uphill battle in his own state because he's associated with the big bonuses on Wall Street and at AIG. Do you have any confidence in Chris Dodd carrying the flag for regulation and basically banking his political future on getting something tough into a new law? Peter Morici and then Arthur Levitt.
Well, I don't think it's fair to pick on Chris, Because the system requires these guys to raise lots of $5,000 contributions to run for office. And the places where you can find them are Silicon Valley, Hollywood, and Wall Street, because you have a lot of highly paid executives. And as a consequence, whether it's Chris Dodd or someone else, they're going to have taken substantial campaign. You can rest assured that his opponent is going to get a lot of cash from Wall Street. They're going to hedge their bets.
Yeah.
So getting rid of Chris Dodd is not the problem. The problem is the campaign finance system and the fact that the guys who are running for, that are going to be on the banking committee will all have that
right.
problem.
All right, Peter Morici, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland. Arthur Levitt, give us a final word, Arthur.
Than almost anyone else in the Congress. I think that he understands that his election is probably dependent upon the image that he's trying to establish of being a populist. He knows the issues. I personally know that he's working very hard on a reform bill that will give greater power to investors.
Well, Arthur Lever, former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, has confidence in Chris Dodd, maybe less confidence from Peter Morici, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland. Thanks, guys.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So, good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. You know, scratch your head. Is it truth-telling that's going on in the past week, or is it just bad behavior we're seeing around the country lately? I mean, we got Joe Wilson from South Carolina heckling the President of the United States during a joint session of Congress. "You lied," he said. This week, Serena Williams lost her cool, fined $10,000 in fines for verbally attacking a U.S. Open lineswoman for a call, which looked like a bad call, a footfall call that may have cost her the U.S. Open. And then there's Kanye West, who broke script at the MTV Video Music Awards to get in the face of Taylor Swift. Listen to this.
"I always dreamed about what it would be like to maybe win one of these someday, but I never actually thought that would happen. I sing country music, so thank you so much for giving me a chance to win a VMA award.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time. One of the best videos of all time."
Awkward moment. Lot to cover here. In these outbursts over the past week, what do you think?
John, Dartmouth, Massachusetts. I think the problem with outbursts are the person who commits an outburst thinks it doesn't happen very often. But the person who feels that outburst feels like it's happening continually. It's never going to stop.
Well, what do you think about outbursts? We've been asking you for the last couple of days. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here to help settle something or maybe just provoke people to have more outbursts over the next few hours is Randy Cohen, writer of the New York Times Magazine's The Ethicist column. Good morning, Randy.
Morning, John.
And LaToya Peterson, editor of the blog Racialicious, a blog about the intersection, of race and pop culture, is here in the studio. Good morning, LaToya.
Good morning.
What is happening here? Your general impressions. LaToya, you first, and then Randy Cohen. And I have a theory, which I'll give you a little bit later, and you can attack me for that if you like. But LaToya, you begin.
Well, you're definitely seeing three different types of outbursts here. One, you have the political sector with Joe Wilson hollering out "You lie," which has some very interesting undertones, particularly about race and how we deal with civility in society and the office or more or less the decorum that comes with having the president. Mm-hmm. With Serena Williams, you have a sports-related outburst, which I thought was extremely interesting because she was responding to a bad call. And even though she overreacted, I found it quite interesting to see people like, you know, John McEnroe, of all people, talking about how she shouldn't have done it and how it was a terrible thing when that was kind of his whole reputation.
But we raised the race issue with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor, yesterday, and the blogosphere erupted with, like, "You made the wrong comparison. What are you talking about here that's way out of line with Serena Williams?" What do you think about that?
In terms of the race issue with Serena Williams, there are undertones in tennis and in how she's been dealt with since she stepped onto the courts, her and her sister Venus, that complicate this particular situation. Mm. So if you look at the situation itself,
it raises the issue. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily excuse her behavior, I guess.
Right, exactly, precisely.
Randy Cohen, your impressions.
I think that it's less of a departure from civility than you might assert, that we haven't been nearly as civil a country, as you might say, especially when you consider the Wilson thing. Remember, in 1856, Preston Brooks, senator from South Carolina, beats Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner to the ground in the Senate chamber, beats him to the ground with a cane, while Representative Lawrence Keate, also from South Carolina, holds back anybody from intervening at gunpoint in the Senate. That's how we do things in this country.
Today they wouldn't do that, actually, publicly on the Glenn Beck show, I guess, is what you're saying, Randy.
But not in the Senate chamber. And there's remarkably little cane beating on the Glenn Beck show, even to the people who you might think deserve it. That there was never this golden age of civility in American culture. We've been a thuggish, racist, two-fisted country for a long time, and I think we flatter ourselves when we see this as a great departure from our gilded age.
All right, well, let me posit a theory here. If there is a through line of these outbursts, Joe Wilson, Serena Williams, and Kanye West, it seems to me that perhaps one can say, since Barack Obama's inauguration, there's some sense out there in the culture that people can say what's on their mind, finally, whether it's Joe Wilson or Kanye West or Serena Williams, that somehow people are going to speak their mind, and they think that it's what other people are thinking, but in fact, it sounds pretty ugly when you actually play it back. LaToya?
Definitely. There's definitely been more of a polarizing context in society after the elections, dividing, you know, Democrats against Democrats, dividing Republicans against Democrats, having this huge, huge divide. I think what's important to remember in the Joe Wilson situation is that this is not a disenfranchised person trying to speak truth to power in the only way he knows. I mean, he's a member of Congress. He has access to quarters of power. And he did an enormous breach of not only decorum, but doing so on a televised in a televised arena the way that it was. It's almost kind of an expression of outright hostility.
But he's not going to apparently apologize, whereas Kanye West goes on Leno last night to apologize. Let me play you one of our listeners who really got mad at us for making any kind of comparison between Serena and Joe Wilson. Listen to this.
Hi, this is Sally calling from New Jersey. I'm a fan of your program, but I thought your reporting yesterday was particularly weak. That was an outburst by a self-centered individual, and it was quite different from Joe Wilson's outburst, which actually represents the thoughts and the sentiments and the concerns of millions of Americans.
Is there a difference without a distinction there, Randy Cohen?
No, there's a real difference there. That Serena was rude, but she was at least plausibly right. It was a terrible call, and it was a trivial outburst in a sports setting. Joe Wilson was not just thuggish in his break from congressional tradition, but he was wrong. Let's not forget that. That's not insignificant. The president did not lie. He was completely accurate the way he depicted the health reform bill and its effect on illegal immigrants.
Although the listener says, Randy, and I'll direct this to LaToya since we're running out of time here, the listener suggests that Joe Wilson represents the feelings of millions of Americans.
As I wrote for Jezebel.com when the incident occurred, people seem to be really latching on to this, but it's really belligerence masquerading as bravery. What he said was absolutely incorrect. And then when he released that YouTube video directly afterward, it was also incorrect, and yet no one seems willing to fact check that. They're holding on to the animosity.
Well, Randy, I'm going to give you the last word, but let's hear a couple of listeners for a moment.
Hi, this is Mike from Wayne, New Jersey. I cannot believe that he's going to turn this into a racial or gender issue. She told the referee that she was going to shove the racket down her throat. Now, we can talk about McEnroe or the past, but in today's game, you lose a point for that. You shouldn't make excuses for these people. They should be better behaved than that.
Should we all be better behaved than that, or should we just sort of look at history and go, you know what, we're a thuggish country, period? Randy?
Oh no, I'm all for courtesy. I'm all for civility. But by the way, Serena did not threaten to shove the racket down anybody's anything. It was the ball, a much less painful process than having a racket shoved into any part of your anatomy.
That kind of precision is why we love Randy Cohen, writer of the New York Times Magazine's The Ethicist column, and LaToya Peterson, also right here in the studio, editor of the blog Racialicious, a blog about the intersection of race and pop culture. Thank you both. Outburst, that's the conversation today. Coming up, Americans spent at a faster rate last month. Where are you spending your money? What kind of economic sign is it? More on that in just a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Got some good news and some bad news on the economy. Retail sales way up, but wholesale inflation also way up. The Wall Street Journal's Kelly Evans is going to explain whether it is good news or bad news. Wall Street's open. It's not taking it well. Dow is flat to negative as Wall Street gets underway. The other headlines, Femi Okeh has them.
Thanks, John. 28 minutes to the top of the hour. It looks like the Republican Congressman Joe Wilson will face a scolding for his outburst during President Obama's address on health care last week. Democratic aides say that House leaders are preparing to introduce a resolution of disapproval this afternoon, with a vote likely later in the day. Also in Washington, the health care push continues. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus says that he will have a formal health care reform proposal tomorrow. Overseas, American and Somali officials say that U.S. forces have been involved in an attack on al-Qaeda-linked militants in East Africa. Our partner, the New York Times, says that one of those killed was, I'm going to quote them here, one of the most wanted Islamic militants in Africa. And finally, actor Patrick Swayze has died from pancreatic cancer at the age of 57. He is best known for his roles in movies like Ghost and Dirty Dancing. Those are some of the top stories we're watching today. John.
Thank you, Femi. So what we've got for you this morning are two, economists call them coincident indicators. And they actually indicate what's going on right now in the economy. Good news from cash registers. Retail sales jumped 2.7% in August. That's the biggest increase in 3.5 years. That's got to be good news, right? The Cash for Clunkers program seems to have been a pretty important element of that increase. But also, wholesale inflation seems to be way up, too. What's going on here? Kelly Evans joins us from the Wall Street Journal. Nice to have you back, Kelly.
Good to speak with you.
So clearly, because retail sales and the consumers are so much a part of the domestic economy in the United States, retail sales up, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, people pretty much expected this increase, John, for exactly the reason you mentioned, which was that the Cash for Clunkers program had a big impact on motor vehicles in August. And those are a big part of retail sales. They're not just, by the way, sales at sort of shops and stores. It's also autos, it's restaurants, department stores. So there's a lot going on here. But what was really encouraging about the report was that excluding autos, sales still rose 1.1% after a dip in July. So that was really seen as sort of the bellwether of whether consumer demand really was on the increase last month, and it appears it was.
Consumers are being choosy, though. The retail sectors are fairly narrow here, right?
Yeah, if you look at sort of what's emerging in consumer spending, which is more than two-thirds of gross domestic product, so it's a big part of the economy. That's why we talk so much about it. But, you know, it really fell sharply in the second half of last year, particularly as oil prices reached highs. And this year, it's been much more stable. It's declined a little bit in the first part of the year, then stabilized. This quarter, it's on track to grow about 2%. So we're still talking about lower levels than a year ago, but people are spending, and they're just being more cautious with their money. They're looking for that value. You've got the retailers who focus on value doing much better right now than those who haven't been able to. So the luxury segment, companies like Abercrombie that have been sort of refusing to discount as much are still struggling, but others are hanging in there.
You know, I hate inflation. I suspect you do also. All journalists hate inflation. But some economists say that if retailers can actually make a price increase stick, that's a good sign for the economy. Wholesale inflation posted an increase. Is it good news or bad news?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned at the top that this might not be good news, but I do sort of feel the opposite with this one, which is that right now, there's so much weakness still in the U.S. and sort of global economy. There's a lot of concern because of high unemployment rates and about the outlook, not just this quarter, but really beyond that. And so there's the struggle right now between rising commodity prices and weakness in the economy. And if you look at the producer prices, which measure prices that sort of manufacturers pay before they pass them along to you and I, but they show a little bit of price pressure. And right now, that's kind of an encouraging thing. And I know that's a weird thing to say, and certainly some of it's driven by higher commodity prices. But at least at this point, we're not seeing sort of the real deflationary tendencies that are a concern. Now, the comparisons, I will say, by the way, too, and the reason why people are a little cautious to talk about these is that the increase in oil prices last year and then the sharp rundown are still affecting the way that these figures look. So it's going to take a couple more months for the trend to really be clear.
All right. So in between all the sort of commodity issues, which are structural in the economy to a certain extent, if people are able to keep their prices, make them stick, it's an encouraging sign that demand isn't collapsing. Kelly Evans, Wall Street Journal reporter, thanks so much for that.
Sure.
All right. Joining us now again, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Yesterday, we asked listeners for some questions about health care, and Todd's going to actually help us this morning answer some of your questions. Todd, good morning.
Hi, good morning, John.
Let's begin with what Rachel Bird wrote us to ask. The president said last week that the reasons to not try for a single-payer or pure market approach to health care reform was because they do not build on what currently exists. Well, she writes, there is currently no infrastructure for nonprofit co-ops. They were almost completely demolished when they became for-profits in the 1980s and 90s. How does that provide a more viable option? She's referring to the nonprofit co-ops.
Well, it's a great question because in terms of reforming healthcare, nobody knows the answer to that. Co-ops are really a political solution to a political problem, which is keeping the existing healthcare system, which is a mess, is untenable. The public option or a public plan has become politically more or less untenable, especially in the Senate. So co-ops have been put forward as kind of a compromise, and that's all it really is. Now, it may work. It may not. Time will tell. I'm sorry to use a cliche, but the idea really is a compromise. They're supposed to be nonprofit, so you're not, you know, scraping 15-18% profit off of people who need health care. No high salaries for executives, not high marketing costs, things like that. So in terms of a solution, it's a political solution, and we'll have to see if they wind up going the co-op route, which is still right. Uncertain. We'll see if it works.
Well, it sounds like her question about there is no infrastructure may be exactly what Congress is going to have to deal with in terms of the regulations to create this infrastructure. Jesse from New York has a question. I've heard a lot about how insurance reform will affect people with insurance from all-sized companies, but what about freelancers? Any more info?
Oh, a question near and dear to any journalist's heart. Most freelancers, I would assume, buy their coverage on the individual market. And that's what a lot of the reform that's been controversial is all about. You've heard of the exchanges, right? Well, the exchange is designed specifically for people who have to buy their own coverage, either because their employer doesn't offer coverage, or they're self-employed, or they work for a small employer who doesn't offer it. It's designed so that they can have a marketplace where insurers compete for their business. So that's what the exchange is designed to do. If there's a co-op or possibly a public option, but more likely a co-op, it will be one of the options
right.
on the exchange it's along like, with all the other private insurers.
It's like LendingTree. When insurance companies compete, you win. That's the
theory.
I think
that's the idea.
Can it actually work?
That's more or less the theory.
But can it work?
Well, you know, if the companies are all together showing their prices, showing their benefits, and it's easier for you to shop, and hopefully there'll be a standardized way for them to report their benefits and their prices, no smoke and mirrors, we shall see.
We shall see. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, answering your healthcare questions. There was a lot there in that segment. Coming up, we'll talk about the late Ted Kennedy's memoir. It just came out. More on it in 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Certainly the name Al-Qaeda is familiar to Americans. We've talked about Al-Qaeda in Iraq, certainly in Afghanistan, where Barack Obama in the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan is believed to be with Al-Qaeda's senior leadership, but we don't know the exact whereabouts. But what about the Somalia? Here's a name for you. Salah Ali Salah Nabhan, the ringleader of an Al-Qaeda cell in Kenya. We have a report from our partner, the New York Times, that American forces have killed one of the most wanted Islamic militants in southern Somalia near the border of Kenya. Jeffrey Gettleman joins us now. He's the East Africa bureau chief for the New York Times. Jeffrey Gettleman, what is the significance of this report and how much of an operation is going on in Somalia of U.S. forces looking for leaders of Al-Qaeda?
Well, I think it's pretty important what happened yesterday. This guy, Nabhan, was one of the key Al-Qaeda figures in East Africa, and the U.S. government has been trying to hunt him down for years. He is not only involved with Al-Qaeda and planning bombings like he did in Kenya in 2002. He's the one who supposedly organized the bombing of a hotel that killed a number of Israelis on the Kenyan coast in 2002. But in addition to that, he is leading the resistance to Somalia's moderate Islamist government, and he is working and training and helping recruit jihadists from all over the world to come to Somalia and fight this holy war. So our information was the U.S. government in this raid killed him and some colleagues yesterday, And if that's true, and we have no reason to doubt it, that's going to be a pretty big blow to the militant movement in Somalia.
Well, certainly part one of the surprise is understanding the infrastructure of al-Qaeda that is apparently there in the Horn of Africa in Somalia. But the other part of the surprise is the deployment of troops in East Africa. Are we to understand that there are American forces stationed in Kenya operating in Somalia to prevent al-Qaeda from getting a foothold, or is this a one-off?
No, there have been American forces in this region for some time. The Bush administration launched a number of airstrikes against terrorist targets in Somalia over the last couple years. There are intelligence agents, either with the CIA or other American government agencies, in Somalia helping coordinate an anti-terrorism operation. There's also been a lot more American interest in Somalia in the last year because of the rampant piracy problem. And these pirates, as we remember from a few months ago, they even hijacked an American ship and held an American sea captain hostage for several days.
Well,
so there is an intense American interest in keeping an eye on Somalia.
Well, you describe it like a scene from a Tom Clancy book. Salah Ali Salah Naban, ringleader of an al-Qaeda cell in Kenya, American forces found him in two trucks and four military helicopters materializing over the horizon, shooting at the two trucks and apparently killing him and whoever was with him. Jeffrey Gettleman reports for the East Africa Bureau, our partner, the New York Times. Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, True Compass, Ted Kennedy's memoir, is a unique piece of writing and a unique piece of history. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. We're also talking about outbursts. Everyone's doing them. Kanye, Serena Williams, Joe Wilson. Are they a bad thing, and can you recover? Does saying I'm sorry, like Kanye West did last night on Jay Leno, actually make it okay?
I gotta say, Kanye, I really thought you were the biggest jerk on the planet whenever I heard what you did, but your apology on Jay Leno was pretty sincere last night, and I think I have room in my heart to forgive.
All right. How much room is in your heart? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now a check of the morning's top stories with Femi Oke.
Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour, Wall Street is now open and traders are chewing on two big economic reports just out this morning. Retail sales and wholesale prices are both up, each rose more than expected. Those numbers will be on the president's mind as he heads to Ohio and Pennsylvania for speeches to auto workers and union members. He'll also talk health care. And after that, he'll head to Philadelphia for a fundraiser to help out Senator Arlen Specter. The lawmaker switched with the GOP earlier this year. A top Democrat says that a deal is close on a compromise health bill in the Senate. Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus says he'll unveil a bill tomorrow. He hopes the lower price tag will get a few Republican votes.
We're going ever closer to moving legislation that will lower costs and ensure that Americans have quality, affordable health care.
A small bipartisan group has been working on the legislation for weeks. Moving overseas, Vice President is in Iraq today. The visit is his third trip there this year. He's meeting with troops and allies. Now, this comes as our partner, the BBC, reports that America's top commander in Iraq is urging Washington not to forget about the mission there. In an interview before the VP's visit, General Ray Odierno said that he doesn't want the new focus on Afghanistan to detract from the Iraq effort. And finally, tributes are pouring in for the actor Patrick Swayze. He's dead at 57 of pancreatic cancer. He played tough guys and passionate lovers on the big screen. And some of his greatest hits, Dirty Dancing, Ghost, Roadhouse, Point Break. And those are some of the top stories we're watching today. John.
Thank you, Femi. So once we learned that Senator Ted Kennedy had died, all around the world there were remembrances and tributes to Kennedy's life and legacy. Here are some of the voices.
Like all Americans, and I think people around the world, we're distressed at the death of a great man.
For my grandfather's commitment and persistence.
Those of us who loved him know Ted Kennedy by the other titles he held.
father, brother, the grand fromage.
To that list of titles, we should probably add the title author now. Ted Kennedy actually wrote a memoir. It began before he was diagnosed with cancer and was published. In fact, the first copy, we understand, was delivered to Teddy Kennedy on the day that he died. The book is called True Compass, and joining us is Jonathan Karp. Jonathan is publisher and editor-in-chief of 12, a publishing house that releases about 12 books a year. And 12 is the publisher of True Compass. Jonathan Karp, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming to the studio, because I sort of read this book when it was, couriered over to me. I also talked to the New York Times reporters who read it in the advance copy that they got. It seems to me this is a unique memoir for a whole variety of reasons. How did you get approached by the Kennedys, I presume, with the idea for this project?
They retained the best lawyer in Washington, Bob Barnett, and he contacted publishers, and we met with him about 2 years ago at his home in Washington. And he told us at the outset that he wanted to write a full and honest account of his life, and that it would be candid, and that it would be a work of personal history and national history. And it's very rare that those two qualities are intertwined in this way. And it was a unique story. Every publisher wanted it.
Well, it was certainly a unique story. And, you know, I won't say that the book is a triumph of writing style, but what it is a triumph of is these competing sensibilities of Teddy Kennedy unburdening himself with the historical knowledge that he has, and you can see it on every page. He believes it belongs to us, and that's part of the reason why he's writing this book, to tell everyone the history that only he knows, and also to make a legacy for his family. And at the back of it all is his own personal legacy. Remember me. I was the Kennedy who outlived them all. It's an interesting set of competing narratives, and it makes for a great read.
Thank you. Well, it's a testament. And he loved history. When the first thing I noticed when I walked into his home were all of the history books and contemporary American history, popular historians. He invoked David McCullough a lot. In fact, his strategy in working on the book was to read it out loud with his wife Vicky, because that was what David McCullough and his wife Rosalie did with all of his books. So there was a real conscious effort here to write personal history. Personal history, in fact, by Katharine Graham was another model for this book.
An amazing book.
Yeah.
Teddy Kennedy hardly needed money for this project,
right?
Why did he choose you?
I don't know. I know that it was we got along really well. I had actually been a junior editor on a book by Tip O'Neill, and maybe he felt
that
some...
That probably helped.
I don't think it hurt, but I think we were very enthusiastic about it, and I really can't speak to it beyond that.
Did you believe it would come through to be as candid as Teddy insisted it was going to be when you began to look at the pages and see what he was actually producing?
I had no reason not to think so. He said it at the outset. I mean, that was what was so interesting about it. No one really knew going into this meeting. I mean, publishers have meetings with authors all the time, of eminent people, and you never know what they're going to say. And what was so striking was in the first 5 minutes of the conversation, he said, I want to do this. I want to deal with everything. And he mentioned Chappaquiddick in the first 5 minutes. So we had a very good sense that he was going to put it all out there in a way that he'd never done before. He was also at the right point in his life to do this. He was in his mid-70s at the time. He was healthy. He wasn't up for re-election for a long time. So there was every reason to think that, yeah, this was the time.
For me, the most poignant moments in the book are him describing learning of the deaths of his brothers. And they're all very different stories. The death of Joe, which he kind of wasn't around for. He saw his mother get the news, but he was a young boy at the time. The death of Jack and the death of Bobby.
You're right. Each one affected him differently. And I think that it got harder and harder. And I think Bobby's death probably shook him up the most, because it was so so close. And he realized, I think, that he could be next. And he had to live with that. And he actually came to terms with it. What he really had trouble with was the effect that had on his family. And the reason he didn't run for president a second time had more to do with the fears that his family had for him, which I thought was really interesting, and it wasn't something that I had understood until I began working on the book.
Besides that, what else did you learn that was of most interest to you as a historian and as a publisher who loves the juicy detail? I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here.
Well, I asked him who his favorite, who he thought the best president he had worked with was, excluding his brother. And I was a little surprised by his answer, not completely, but his answer was Lyndon Johnson. He felt that because of his legislative accomplishments, what Johnson had done to move the country forward on civil rights, which he felt was the moral issue of our time, and obviously all of the Great Society programs. He liked working with Bill Clinton enormously. He really liked Bill Clinton a lot, but he thought that Johnson was the best president of his lifetime. And Vietnam obviously was a tragic and terrible mistake, but he had an interesting way of talking about Vietnam. I mean, Ted Kennedy himself changed his position on the Vietnam War halfway through. And you can read this book through the prism of Iraq and realize that Ted Kennedy had similar issues that a lot of politicians had at that time. I mean,
before we go, what happened to Kennedy's demons? I mean, in the annals of confessional literature, the demons are partly what sells the book. Where did they go?
I think that some of that has been exaggerated by the media over the years. I think that he came to terms certainly with all of the loss in his life through his faith in his family. That's what his true compass was, and that's what centered him, and that's what gave him his purpose.
Jonathan Karp is publisher of Ted Kennedy's memoir, True Compass. He's the editor-in-chief of 12, a publishing house that releases about 12 books a year. Thank you so much, Jonathan. And if you want to listen to anything on the show, like our coverage of Ted Kennedy's passing, you can find it on our website, thetakeaway.org, and you could subscribe to our podcast there as well. We're also talking about outbursts all morning. Everyone's doing them. Kanye, Serena Williams, Joe Wilson. Are outbursts really a bad thing? Does saying I'm sorry, like Kanye West did last night on Jay Leno, actually make it okay? You can weigh in at thetakeaway.org. I mean, I'm going to go on Leno tonight and say I'm sorry for confusing Osama bin Laden for Barack Obama earlier in the program this morning. Actually, Leno just canceled. He's got more important celebrities on the program tonight. You can reach us at 877-8MYTAKE or at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. Todd Zwillick will be here for the next 2 days. I'm off to Cleveland. Why? Why? I feel an outburst coming on. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.